If you're struggling in your career, business, or life, this podcast is for you. 9/11 survivor Ari Schoenbrunn shares inspiring interviews so you too can rise like a phoenix from the ashes to live your best life. Here's your host, Ari.
Welcome to Whispers and Bricks. My name is Ari Sherman. I am your host. We have the honor and privilege of having a wonderful, wonderful individual who has faced many trials and tribulations in her life. You are going to love her story. You're going to love how she recreated herself in essence. Carly Israel is a co-parenting coach at In Your Corner Divorce. She's the author of Seconds and Inches, a memoir. She is a contributor at the Huffington Post. And she hosts two podcasts of her own. The first one is called In Your Corner Divorce. And the second one is North Star Big Book. She's the mother of three wild boys, sober warrior, and beautiful mess. Please help me welcome Carly Israel.
Thank you so much. I am so excited to be on with you today.
Yeah, terrific. Okay, so I'm going to start with what I know.
Okay.
And that basically is, I read your book, Seconds and Inches, and I was totally, totally blown away. It was just like, I want to say I couldn't put it down, but I had to put it down. You know what I'm saying? There were so many places where I just started to cry and my heart went out and I had to put the book down just to be able to recover. But what a great read.
Will you tell me any of the places that were hard for you?
Oh, there were a bunch of places that were hard. There really were. And at the end of the podcast, I'm going to ask you how my audience, my listeners can get a hold of your book.
Okay.
Okay. Now, your podcast, In Your Corner Divorce, that's pretty much self-explanatory. I get it. All right. People go through a divorce. What is a co-parenting coach? What is North Star Big Book and who or what is Sober Warrior?
I'm going to connect all of them because everything's connected, as you know. So I got sober January 27th, 1999, which would have been the day I died. It was either going to be the day I died or the day I got sober. And from that period of time, I've become a sober warrior because, as you know, a warrior is going to have cuts and bruises and blood and they're going to have been seasoned, which I am, and I've fought a lot of battles, but because of them, I've found my way through my higher power and God and connecting and North Star. So when I was going through my divorce, which who wants to go through a divorce? But it was what was happening. And I refused that idea that my kids were going to be like messed up and need therapy and we were not going to talk. And I said to my friend who I knew was doing a really good job at being divorced, how do I do this? And he said, do you know what the North Star is? I was like, kind of. And he's like, it's what sailors use when they're lost in the dark and they can't find their way home. And when you're lost in the dark, which you are right now, you're going to look up to the North Star, but the North Star for you is going to be your three boys. And you are going to focus on them. And that's always going to guide you through the storm. And so that's become my concept of a divorce and how I figure out how to coach people to focus on their kids. And it also goes back to Big Book because I have a podcast where I take men and women all over the world through the pages in the book that helped me stay sober.
Wow. Wow. And what is a co-parenting coach?
Great question. So divorce doesn't have great representation out there. It's not like a great marketing word. Co-parenting is about two people that want to not mess up their kids. Their marriage didn't work out. They know that they have to go through this process. It's not an easy process. And they need to learn how to parent together, like a coach, like a co-pilot. And so I coach parents either one-on-one virtually or both of them if they're both inclined. Focusing on getting rid of their stuff, all their yucky stories about what happened and their scorecards, and focusing on what do you want for your children going forward in two homes.
Wow. Okay. Wow. Now, as you know, the name of the podcast is Whispers and Bricks, and the whispers are those voices telling you what is the right thing to do. They represent the good in life. And the bricks represent the bad things that we all go through in life. We all get hit with a brick at some point in time or another. I don't know anybody that hasn't been hit with a brick of some kind. Now, the reason I asked you to be on my show is because after I read your book, I knew that there were people in my audience who were going through the exact same things that you had gone through. They had been hit with brick after brick, much like what you had gone through, and they needed to hear and to know that they could get through the trials and tribulations the same way that you did. They needed to know that there were whispers out there that could save them. So in your life, you have had many, many bricks thrown at you, from drug abuse, alcoholism, bad marriage, an ill child. I mean, the list goes on and on. Now, can you take us back to those troublesome years and tell us how you managed to get through it all? Like, give me the 20-minute version. Perfect. I don't need the whole book version. I just want like the 20-minute version.
Before I go there, I want to tell you that I love your explanation of what the whispers and bricks are. And because I've read your book 4 times, because I read it for myself, I heard your story, and I have 3 boys, and we all read it 1 at a time together, and they loved it.
Like, wow, thank you.
Wrote reports on you. But I thought that whispers and bricks were about the literal bricks that were coming down for you in the buildings, and the whispers of your universe and God telling you, like, keep going.
So very interesting. That's what it's all about.
Awesome. So for me, I'll give you the short version. I have to back up enough to tell you why I wrote the book. So I was sitting in Yom Kippur at services, and I heard a rabbi say, because, you know, like for the holidays, for people who don't know, the Jewish holidays, you're supposed to be reflecting and thinking about what kind of life you want to live and what you want going forward and what you want to change. And this rabbi said that he heard the story, it was actually of Mark Zuckerberg from Facebook, who did a year's worth of letters, thank you letters, to people in his life that made his life brighter. And I was like, I like challenges that force me, because like, if you do something for a year every day, it's going to change you. But I don't know about you, but I was never going to be able to write a letter every day and actually send it, because who are we kidding? So I made the decision I was going to do a post every day on social media, which I did. And my posts were really well liked, because one of the gifts I have is writing. You know what your gifts are when you know them. I think we have this very similar one, speaking and writing and teaching. And so anyways, one of my sons came home crying. We live in a beautiful neighborhood, very family friendly, lots of kids. And he went out to play. This is my middle kid, big glasses, legally blind. And he never goes out with the other kids. He goes out, he comes back crying. And I'm like, what's happening? He's like, the kids told me I couldn't play with them. And my heart just like, kids are jerks, right? Yeah. And you know, and I didn't want to be like, well, sticks and stones can't hurt you, because like, that's not true, right? They do hurt.
Yeah.
So that day I hadn't written my thank you post for my daily post. And I had a great talk with my son. And my thank you that day was to the kid on my street that made fun of my kid. And the reason why it was my thank you was because that kid taught us a great lesson. We had a great conversation, and we really had to focus on like, what kind of person do we want to be in the world? That post ended up getting more comments and likes than any of them. And people were like, give us more like this. Wow. So I did. A year goes by, they're like, you can't stop writing. And I was like, okay. So I did a year of challenges, and I got a message, will you turn this into a book from a publisher? And I did. And in order for me to write my story, and as you know, because you've read it, I can't just share my story, because it's not mine alone. I carry with me the stories of my ancestors. And one of the critiques I got from my book over and over was, you could have turned this into 4 books. Because first part is written my ancestors who were Holocaust survivors. We had a fatal fire and addiction. And then the middle part is kind of like my mess of addiction and life and marriage and kid. And then the last part is my renaissance of coming through it. And then intertwined is all the thank yous to the people. But the reason why I can't turn that into 4 books is because it's all I know. I'm never going to make up something, right? The memories, my whispers of the bricks were from my ancestors who are no longer here. And I'm not going to like put filler in there so people can like feel like they have more of a story. So I like the idea of giving little snippets of our story so people can understand where we're coming from. Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
So I'll just give you a little bit of background to not ruin anything. I'm 22 years sober today. I'm 41 years old. I have 3 boys. Growing up, I grew up in a beautiful life, Jewish family, both sides. My grandparents were Holocaust survivor on one side. My other grandparents never talked about anything. And we didn't know a lot of their story. And I ended up growing up in an alcoholic home. And for anyone that's listening that grew up in an alcoholic home, there's very, very clear things that it looks like. You can't talk about what's going on inside. You have to keep your outside looking good. So you got to get good grades. You got to dress nice. You need to act appropriate. And you can't tell anybody what's going on. And so that was the house I grew up in. And my parents ended up getting sober when I was about 13, and I had already started using and drinking then, and we kind of missed each other.
So your parents were alcoholics, mm-hmm. and you became an alcoholic?
Yeah.
At what age?
So I don't know the age I actually became an alcoholic, but I had my first drunk, a Manischewitz wine, at 9 when I was at Passover dinner. It was totally acceptable that we're all drinking because everyone was drinking. And, you know, if you're Jewish, you can't be an alcoholic, you know, that because it might dull the pain. So you can't like talk about it. And, you know, looking back, I got to tell you, and this is pretty interesting, and there's actually going to be a cool webinar about this. My mother, myself, and my grandmother, the three of us, okay? And my grandmother was 19 when my mother was born. My mom had us pretty young too. It's typical. Beautiful, wonderful women. I was the first in all of my family's history to graduate college, to like, wow, to kind of like become. But she was a Holocaust survivor. My mom was first generation American, came to this country and said, like, we can't complain about anything because anytime I want to talk about something, I'm like, my parents were in the Holocaust. Like, you know, so.
Oh,
right.
Yeah. Yeah, so yeah. I think
my generation is the first generation that's able to talk about it in a way that is like people want to listen.
Right.
So we're actually doing the, here's the crazy part, Ari. All three of us are sober. Myself, my mother, and my grandmother.
Your grandmother was an alcoholic?
At 80 years old, she got sober.
Oh my God. I didn't know that part.
Yeah. So she got sober at 80. She always drank, but she was like the kind of alcoholic that could keep it together and didn't look messy like my mother and myself. But I also knew that I never let my kids drive with her because I knew she drank a lot. Shabbos was her most important time of the week, and all the family would always come over. And it just got to the point where it was so bad that it was, Shabbos was a nightmare. It was like she was slurring her words and it was getting messy. And I didn't want to impose anything on her because, as you know, I'm sober and I know you can't make somebody sober. But what I did was I stood up for my three kids in a way that no one did for me when I was growing up. And I said, we can't come here anymore. I couldn't tell her what to do. I just said, and I didn't say it in front of anyone. I just told her privately, I love you. Yeah. We can't come here anymore. And she said, why? And I said, I can't put my kids through what I went through. And she's told me since then, we've had many talks, that that was what she needed. That was the brick that she needed.
That she needed.
Yeah. So, and she's 87 years old now, and she's been through everything. And she's actually one of the reasons why I'm a co-parenting coach, because when I told her I was going through my divorce, her first words were, I'm not God. I will never judge you. And I've went through the Holocaust, Carly. And I can tell you that the worst thing that's ever happened in my life was being an adult child of divorce from my two parents. And I was like, yeah, I didn't know that either. She said as an adult, she would be at one of their houses for dinner for a holiday. And they would be like, where are you going? If like she looked at her watch or got up, are you going to go see your other parent? And made her feel horrible. And she's like, you can never do that to your kids. And I'm like, thank you.
Yeah. You started drinking at 9. And if I remember from the book, you were certainly an alcoholic by the age of 13.
Yeah. Okay? I mean, what an alcoholic is, at least the way I work with women about it, is you can't control the amount you put in your body when you have it in your body. So like if you decide you're not going to get drunk, you get drunk because you just can't stop drinking. Or when you don't have it in your body, you're like, I am miserable without this in my body, which is how I felt all the time.
At what point did you stop drinking?
So my parents got sober when I was 13. I was already off and running, and I did not allow them to be my parents for the rest of my like high school growing up because I was resentful. And I was like, don't impose any of your parental structures onto me. You've been MIA for the last 13 years.
Wow.
You know, because by the time I was 9, I knew how to make dinner. I knew to call the carpool and tell them that we couldn't come. I had learned how to grow up.
Wow.
Which is kind of interesting because you've read my story. My grandfather that ended up escaping the gas chambers lived by himself in the woods at age 9.
Yeah.
And my father at age 8 stood by his sister's funeral by himself. No one else was there in the immediate family. So it's like I'm seeing all these patterns of our ancestors growing up at an age that no one should be growing up at.
Right. Right.
And so back to your question, my story, you know, I don't want to spoil it, but I got sober in college, Ohio University. It was either going to be the date of my death or the date of my sobriety date. And thank God I didn't get what I wanted.
Wow. Okay. So that's the alcoholic part. Now take us through the issue with your sons, with your ill child.
Yes. So I loved being a mother. I would have had a gaggle of kids if I could have. I had three boys back to back, and my youngest son, Levi, in the book, it was a pretty intense couple of days in the NICU, but I'd already had a NICU baby before. At that point, I still like was okay. I was still like, we're going to be okay. And me and God are tight, and whatever's going to happen is going to happen for a reason. We're okay. And we're going to be okay. And at this point, 6 months into his life, my uncle, who's a cardiologist, says, Carly, there's something wrong with the way his head looks. He had no hair, like babies don't have no hair. The veins in his head were really, really poofy. They kind of look like, one nurse joked and was like, Medusa was like on top of his head, just like a poofy, like spider octopusy looking thing.
Wow.
And long story short, we ended up in the worst position any parent could possibly be placed in, which is our son was told by the best pediatric neurosurgeons in the country and the world that what he had, no one has ever had before, ever. There's zero other humans that have his condition. And there were two differing opinions from all the medical facilities that were the best. And one group said, if you don't do something about his condition, which was basically part of the drainage from his brain to his heart and back again, was blocked off, completely blocked off. And they'd never seen it before in a baby. They'd seen it in a stroke victim because a stroke happened. Right. They'd never seen a baby. And they said, you have to intervene or else he's going to get something called venous hypertension, which is a backup of blood, and you die. Or if you intervene, he will die on the table. Because what they want to do is they want to cut off the part that's closed off and reattach a different part, but they'd never done it. It was like Grey's Anatomy, like the finale, like the worst thing you could possibly imagine. And they left it up to us as parents. Like, what do you want to do?
So what did you do?
So I spent 5 weeks in some of the darkest places of my life, walking through every moment, getting emails and phone calls from doctors everywhere. What I talk about in the book, what you can tell from me, is I'm a fighter. I'm a warrior. And, you know, my last name, Israel, means one who wrestles with God. And I knew, even what was going on, that if there was anyone that should be given this brick, it should be me, because I will do anything on earth for my kid. And I did. And I fought and I advocated. And we ended up at Boston Children's Hospital because they were the only, this story you'll love. And I think it was in the book. I always get this wrong. You'll help me. Michelangelo is the artist. And then David is the art piece.
Yes.
So I heard this story a long time ago that Michelangelo did not create David. He just removed everything that wasn't David. And I loved that concept because while we were going through this horrible process of where do we take our kid and what do? Each institution dropped out once they got the scans, once they understood the gravity, and all that was left was David, was Boston, right? And so right. I knew going through it, we're going to get an answer. We're going to get a whisper. And we did. And we went there. I remember we were told that we might going to have one or two brain surgeries. We didn't know how far apart they were going to be. He needed an angiogram first. And there was a possibility we would not be bringing him home, like ever. And I remember sitting in that terminal at the airport and holding him. And it was a snowstorm. And it was so scary. And I remember I went to my therapist at the time. And I said, like, I don't know how to do this. And he's like, you're on a mission to save your son. You don't have time for emotions. Like when you were going down the tower, like you don't have time, right?
People don't understand that. And again, what I went through, I don't think is anything compared to what you went through. I went through it for a day. You went through it for years. But I'm just saying that when you're in that situation, you turn into the mode that I've got a mission, whatever it is, I'm going to do in order to get through that mission. And, you know, you just go on autopilot. You just keep plowing through until you're done. And that's,
I mean, you did that.
And that's what I remember going down the 78 flights of stairs. It was
with Virginia,
the burn victim. And it was like, I had a mission. I needed to get her out of that building and I needed to get her into an ambulance. And I was going to do whatever it took. Even
but
when she said to me
what
that
you
I,
do to survive.
Yes.
Like, you need that.
Correct.
I was that person in our marriage. My husband, which is, I stole the term from a friend. He was my husband. He's a great human. He's a great father. We co-parent really well together. That was not his wheelhouse. Like, he could not show up like that. And it was my job. And that's fine. And so when we went there, we found out the best possible scenario for our son, which is when they did the angiogram, they found out that they could not intervene because he would not survive. And that they felt that his brain created a system that was working for him and we're gonna leave it alone. So in the back of his head, he's got two open spaces where his skull doesn't close because if it did, it would crush that system. And then I left there with, you know, PTSD. And 2 months later, he starts getting crazy fevers that go over 107. So we're in ERs for years, searching out solutions. So along the way, you know, I became the woman I am today. And I wanted to ask you this question because it's really been interesting to me. So we both know each other from my synagogue and they're amazing people. But I remember on, I think it was on Yom Kippur, they had like this pamphlet out and one of the prayers to God was, please don't give me anything challenging this year. And I'm not someone who doesn't just let something go. And I said to my rabbi's wife, I said, Ruchi, I don't agree with this. And she said, why not? And I want to know why you would think, why not? Why would I not want to ask God to not give me something challenging?
I think you thrive on the challenge.
But what happens for us from those bricks? What do you get?
Lessons.
Yeah. I mean, don't you think you're a better Ari than you've ever been because of that challenge?
Yes, I absolutely do. But that it wasn't something that I wished for.
Of course not.
Okay. But no, I don't agree. In other words, I think that when, you know, through life, nobody wants to go through challenges. All right. You know, you always hear, I'm up for the challenge. But nobody wants to go through challenges. They get it thrust upon them more often than not. And when they get it thrust upon them, that's when, you know, it's, as they say, that separates the men from the boys. Are you going to crawl up into a little ball and die? Or are you going to meet it head on and do whatever it takes in order to beat it? Now, obviously, you are one of those people who you are not going to crawl up into a little ball
and die.
Neither
are you.
Okay, but this show is about you, not me. So let's go on.
But I want to address this for a second, okay? Here's the deal. And it's what my book is about, right? First of all, one of the things that you shared with me, and I don't know if you share with your other audiences, that about being handed a black piece of canvas, right? And not knowing how it fits into anything and feeling like, what am I supposed to do with this? And then finally being able to step back and see like where it fits into the beautiful picture of your life. I will not ask my God to not give me challenges. Obviously, I don't want to have my son in pain. Obviously, you didn't want to have all those people's lives destroyed in towers.
Right.
But I don't know what's best for the universe, for me, for each other. And I can tell you, I'm a better human today because I'm the mother of Levi.
Okay.
And I'm a better human today because I watch my grandfather cover his eyes when talking about his parents whose faces he doesn't remember because he was 9 the last time he saw them. I have a different perspective and gratitude because of those challenges. So I will never ask not having that. Does that make sense?
To a degree.
Yeah. We can agree to disagree and love each other.
Oh, absolutely. That's 100%.
Yeah.
So what happened with your son? He sent home from Boston Hospital. They're saying, we're not doing anything.
Yeah.
And everybody said, you either need to do this and he'll die. You need to do that. And
right.
Right.
So think of his main system that we all have as the freeway. He can't take the freeway because it's blocked off. His body created side streets that could figure out their own way to get there. His body created it. His body's a genius, right? So his body figured it out and we're moving on. His only problem with his head now is that if he gets trauma to the open area in the back, as I'm not joking, these are the words from the doctor at the pediatric brain surgeon in Boston. He said, I will not operate on your son unless my back is against the wall and the wall is on fire. And if there is trauma to his head, it would look like a Pulp Fiction scene. Because it would be so massive. So that's that one. And the way I deal with that is every time he would be at a play date or a school or a camp or we moved, I would have to go up to whoever it was and say, hey, try not to freak you out, but this is the situation. If this happens, this is what I need you to do. And it's a lot to navigate because you don't want to scare somebody, right?
Right, right.
But you also need them to know this is what I need you to do.
Right. Your husband, you were two different people, really. You were the one who was able to step up. He wasn't, for whatever reason. We never fault people for not being able to do something because, you know, that's their nature. And oftentimes, I know that there was a situation in my family where my parents were going through something with one of my siblings. And my father, who always was the pillar of strength in our family, he was Dave Schoenbrunn. You know, he was 6 feet tall, 225. Really, I mean, he was just a good looking guy. He had everything going for him, whatever. And when this situation happened, he just crawled up and couldn't deal with it. And my mom was the one who had to deal with it. And thank God everything worked out. But I'm just saying, so I've seen it, this big strapping man who we revered, literally. And this issue comes up, he can't deal with it. I never faulted my father for it. It wasn't his strength. That's not what he did. My mom was superwoman. Okay. Like you, she was superwoman. She just was able to deal with it and we got through it. So yeah. I hear that. All right. So what happened? So you just.
And it's not the reason why our marriage didn't last. I always talk about how a marriage, when I coach clients, is like a house and the foundation of a house, and it needs to be strong and it needs both parties to be holding it up. And then when life is going to happen to you, because it happens to all of us, it's going to put weight on that structure. And the weight of dealing with the scary stuff with our son showed more of the cracks than pretty much anything else could have. And even from that, I wanted things to work. We went to marriage counseling on and off for 6 years. We were just different humans. And I think that at the end of the day, no one did anything wrong. I think the best way to communicate it is to say that we were not right for each other. We couldn't be the partner that the other person needed, me included. And so that, you know, is sad, because no one gets married hoping that they're going to not make it.
Right.
As hard as I work as a divorcee and a coach in that area, there's always going to be moments that just suck because you don't get to be with your kids all the time.
Right.
But that was probably the most courageous and challenging thing I've ever done in my life, more than any of the other things, because on the outside, everything was perfect on paper. And on the inside, it was. We literally lived in our dream home that I designed on a compound of my parents and my grandparents, all three generations on the same land.
Wow.
And we had to leave, and it was a big mess in our family.
Wow, wow, wow. Tell us a little bit what happened after the divorce. Like, sure. What is life like right now?
Sure. But
what are you doing right now? And what is life like now? Did you remarry?
Yes. So I met my current husband and hopefully last one, Jonathan, through a ridiculously seconds and inches kind of whispers and bricks moment, all intertwined to everything we just talked about. When our son Levi was really sick after Boston, I came home and he started getting all these fevers and they didn't know what was going on. And now he's on some pretty heavy injections that shut off his immune system. And I was going through a period of time where I couldn't find gratitude. Like, I was just broken and shut off. I was stuck. And I didn't know how to get it back because that's not like me. And I saw someone's post on Facebook, and it was of a picture of a little boy who was 10. It was from his father, who you would love his writing and you guys need to meet each other. I actually was telling him about you the other day. You will love him. His name is Christopher Jones, and his Facebook is Mitchell's Journey. And Christopher talks about himself as an unapologetic photographer. That name sounds familiar to you?
Yes, it actually does.
So his son, Mitchell, had Duchenne's muscular dystrophy, which is terminal, fatal. If your son has it, it's a death sentence. At age 3, they found out, and he started chronicling, writing, and keeping photographs for mostly family, but a quarter of a million followers, in like a journal, but on Facebook. And his writing happens to be ridiculously beautiful. So that day that I was sitting in the car and waiting for Starbucks, being sad and stuck, was the day Mitchell died. I'd never, ever seen his post before that day. And I opened up my Facebook feed and it was that post. And it just broke me open with gratitude and perspective and brought me to my knees. I read the entire thing from the beginning to the end. And I realized that Mitchell's parents, who's Christopher and his wife, Natalie, would do anything on earth to have my problems. And they would do anything to hold their son burning up in the hospital, like I got to hold my son burning up in the hospital. And it changed everything for me. And so I ended up writing a letter, which is interesting because I wrote all these letters in my book, but I think letter writing is really important. I wrote him an email, which I expected him to never read because he has a quarter of a million followers.
Right.
7 months later, he emails me and he's like, I've not stopped thinking about your email and I want to connect with you. This news station is doing a documentary on Mitchell's journey and the effect it's had on people. And would you be okay with them flying from Utah to Cleveland to interview you and your family? And I was like, oh. Yeah. So they did, and we did. And I posted it. And when I posted it, this man named Jonathan, who's now my husband, saw the post. And meanwhile, Jonathan, I only know because he went to high school with my then husband. And I knew that he had lost his daughter to brain cancer and his sister to a horrible car accident.
Oh,
and so
God.
bricks, right?
Right.
He messages me in a private message and he's like, I had no idea this was going on in your life. and we were Facebook friends, but you know, you could be Facebook friends with anyone and never talk to them.
Yeah, yeah.
And so that message felt like a whisper. And I cried when I opened it. I don't know why I cried when I opened it. And I messaged Christopher Jones and I sent him a screenshot and I said, look what you and your son are doing. You're connecting people who would never be connected ever. And we became great friends. And I told my husband all about it. We talked every day. And he said, my husband said he did not care that we talked every day. He didn't care at all that we were having an emotional relationship. And right. We ended up really getting close, like becoming best friends. And as my marriage was crumbling and his marriage was crumbling, I would encourage him, go to therapy, go work it out, go do this, go do that. And when I made the decision to leave, he was still in his place of challenges and everything. And I made the decision to leave, not because of him, but I told my husband my feelings. Like I was 100% honest. And I'd never even touched Jonathan, like never hugged him, nothing.
Right.
I fell in love with who he was as mine was ending. And we became like soulmates. And so it's not optically beautiful, but it's our life. And we live in two different states and we have children in two different states and it's bananas, but you can't choose what your heart wants.
Wow. The divorce itself, was it amicable? You and your husband?
It was supposed to be, but we were also living in our dream home and had to sell it. That took 7 months and we were doing the legal process in the middle of it in the house with little kids while having showings. And so it was really stressful, which is kind of why I became a co-parenting coach, because I don't believe people need to go through the drama of like the legal part of divorce if their focus is on what's in the best interest for the kids. And you know, my husband and I get along really great today. Like 90% of the time we're good and 10% of the time we're not, but who isn't?
Right.
And we live 4 blocks away on purpose. We moved 4 blocks away from each other because you have a bunch of kids. You forget stuff all day long. And so we go back and forth to each other. So, you know, you forgot your cord at your dad's house.
Oh,
and
wow.
Yeah. I mean, we did this on purpose.
Wow. You know, Carly, you are just one special lady. You really are. I hope my audience appreciates the type of person you are and the type of person you've become. And I have no words. I don't think I've ever come across a person quite like you. I'm so happy that you decided to come on my podcast. I think my audience has gotten so much out of this. It's not even funny.
Can I just tell you something? First of all, that's amazing. But I feel like, first of all, I couldn't believe that you were willing to read my book because like you're Ari. And I was like, oh my goodness. And when I read your book, like I said, 4 times, your book could have been called my book's name. It's Seconds and Inches, You Survive. When the ambulance had to move. I mean, I tell your story all the time to people and they're like, I can't believe this. I mean, and I have a question for you. And I know this is not about you, but I have to ask. What inside of you changed, mentally, spiritually, emotionally changed after you've walked out away from there?
Nothing had changed for me. I was the same guy on Wednesday that I was on Tuesday. In 2001. What actually caused the change was people started asking me about my story, my survival, etc. And I started to tell my story. And as I told my story more and more, it really started to sink in what had happened. Okay. Because I didn't appreciate what had happened. I didn't think it was a big deal. You know, as I'm telling my story more and more, and then people come up to me and they go, you've changed my life. I realized that this has been something that was just, as I say, once in a lifetime type thing. And that's when I really, really started to change. And I stopped flying off the handle like I used to. I spent a lot more time with my kids, my wife, my family. You know, that became central. You know, they were the most important things in my life. So once that happens, when you realize what you've been through and that you've made it and God is looking out for you, as a person, you become a better person in general. My neighbor next door, nice guy, sweet guy, right? He's got medical issues, whatever. He was out trying to clean his car off this morning, you know, from the terrible snow. And so I grabbed my brush from my car and I went over to him and he's, Ari, what are you doing? I said, oh, well, I'm helping you. He goes, no, I'm good. I said, yeah, but if there are two of us working, it'll go twice as fast. I mean, I wanted him to know that it wasn't because, you know, I was nervous for him that he shouldn't be working so hard. That kind of like, you know, what do you mean? I don't want to put him in that position. So I put him in the position of, no, the two of us working together will just go twice as fast. That's all, Steve, no big deal. you know, and he really appreciated that. So it's the little things. It's the little things that you do, the little things that you say, you know, the smile.
You don't know what it's going to do to someone. I'm positive you're the same way. When people send me messages about my book, I want them to know, and I make them very, very understanding that it makes a difference for me when I hear those kind words, because they could have kept them to themselves. But if they kept them to themselves, I wouldn't have known the effect that it had, and it wouldn't have given that ripple of kindness. And then my kindness goes on to somebody else, and it matters. I have a really quick question for you. Another one, and then I'm done, I promise. There's someone I need you to have on this site, okay, on your episode, and you probably know how to get in touch with them better than I do. Have you heard of Matty Long from New York? He was the fireman that during the shutoff of the transportation was riding his bike to do a training run, got hit by a bus and stuck underneath the bus. And it like cut him up from whispers and bricks all day. He has a story called The Long Run. And I know you can connect with him because you are Ari and you'll find a way. And if you do, you have to let me know because his story is like yours so much.
Send me a text or an email.
Will love it.
Okay. Is there anything else before we go? Anything else you want to share with the audience? Any words of wisdom?
Yes. So I don't know about you guys, but during this pandemic, my brain is mush and I can barely handle everything that's going on. And so when I'm not doing all the things that we're doing, I have found myself sending these beautiful pieces of art to people all over the world with my two favorite words on them. And they say, get to. So get to has changed my life. I hear myself all the time going, I have to go to the grocery store. And then I say, no, I get to go to the grocery store. I have money. I have a car. I can afford food. I can have put it in my house, right? And my favorite one that I get to is about laundry, because when you have kids, they make a lot of messes.
Yes, they do.
And I think so our laundry's in the basement. And when I think about taking the wet clothes and putting them in the dryer, every load, there's not one I miss when I don't think of this. I think if Levi didn't make it, I would have less clothes to clean. And that would be the most painful act of my whole life, every day, having to do less laundry than I wish I could have done. And that is the get to. I get to do laundry. I get to have messes. I get to have all of it because it's a gift. And so my gift to everybody is to change your words to get to.
Carly, thanks so much for sharing your story with my audience. I'm sure you've touched the hearts of many of the people in my audience. Good luck going forward. Keep up the good work. Keep inspiring people.
Thank you.
Because that's what you do. You inspire. You inspire me. And I'm sure you've inspired people. Now, if somebody wants to get a hold of you, what's the best way for them to do that?
Sure. My email is inyourcornercoach, all one word, inyourcornercoach@gmail.com. You can find Seconds and Inches, which is my book. I'm narrating it if you wanted to listen to the audio, or you can read it on paperback or digital on Amazon or Audible or any of those places. And all my podcasts can be found on anywhere you listen. So if you just wanted to check me out on Facebook under Carly Israel, like the country, you can message me and I am very reachable. So anyway, I'm happy to connect.
And that's Carly, Carly. There's no.
Yeah, I was named after Carly, like Carly Simon, because my parents were really hippies. Yeah. But I can't sing and don't ask me to.
Okay. Well, thanks so much. I appreciate
it. Thank you for having
me. It was my pleasure.
It was the highlight of my day.
Mine too.
Thank you so much.
Okay.
This is just the beginning, Ari.
It absolutely is. It absolutely 100%. Is. And you're in New York. You stop by. I know if I get to Cleveland.
You've got space here always. Thank you so much.
Bye. You've been listening to Whispers and Bricks. I'm your host, Ari Shomer. Until next time, listen to the whispers. Never give up on your dreams. Bye for now.
So that's it for today's episode of Whispers and Bricks. Head on over to iTunes and subscribe to the show. One lucky listener every single week that posts a review on iTunes will win a chance in the grand prize drawing to win a $25,000 private VIP day with Ari himself. Be sure to head on over to whispersandbrickspodcast.com and pick up a free copy of Ari's gift and join us on the next episode.